welcome to Observations. I'm here with Scott and Kirk. And guys, I'd like to start off on a couple of rants. It's kind of my way. I like to rant about this, that, and the other thing. My first rant is that for the fourth week in a row, people who don't know who they are protesting in a place that they don't know its name either. They call themselves Palestinians. They call the place Palestine. Neither exist. And they're protesting over Jerusalem being named the capital of Israel, which is a statement of fact. And they're of the belief that that is offensive to them because they want Jerusalem to be the capital of a mythical people in a mythical place. But to protest these things on behalf of the lie that there is such thing as a Palestine and a people called Palestinian, or that Jerusalem isn't the capital of Israel, is to demonstrate just how corrosive and corrupting religion is to a human mind, completely destroying its ability to be rational. Anyone who would report, support, or participate in a protest in favor of a mythical people called Palestinians and a mythical place called Palestine on behalf of Jerusalem being their capital is, well, there's a word for it, nincompoop. You are so stupid, so perverted, so twisted, either by socialist secular humanism, the religion of political correctness where that which is incorrect is celebrated, that which is truthful is renounced, or you're a mudslime. And you've fallen prey to the world's dumbest religion, the worst religion ever conceived out of the dumbest book, easily the worst book ever written, the Quran. I don't say that to be pejorative. Those are all facts. Mm-hmm. Now, my second rant would be of the nincompoops here in America, and around the world, but particularly Christians. They think that they're doing something for God by celebrating Christmas. Hey, I'm going to ask you a few questions, Kirk. Real simple questions. Was God ever born?
No. Not if he's God.
That's right. So God does not have a birthday.
No.
The birthday that they're celebrating is the birthday of
Tammuz.
Tammuz, right? Tammuz was the first one to be born on the winter solstice. He was the son of the sun. The claim was that the god, the sun, called the Lord, impregnated Mother Earth in the form of Semiramis. At the time, she became known as Astarte and then Ishtar, the basis of the Christian Easter.
Mm-hmm.
On the Sunday, closest to the vernal equinox, which is now celebrated as Easter Sunday, and then 9 months later, which would be December 25th, the winter solstice is when the son of the sun was born. So Cyrus's birthday. It is Bacchus's birthday. It is Dionysus's birthday.
Clue,
folks. What you're doing is purely pagan. And not only has no basis with God, it's just, God finds it disgusting, repulsive. And anybody who is celebrating Christmas and Easter and worshiping on Sundays and is calling himself Christian will be destroyed by God upon his return. You will not survive his return. He despises you. He finds what you're doing to be perverted and disgusting. Now, you don't think so? Then translate the book of Yeshayah, Isaiah. It's written to you. And it is unequivocal. You know, I'm in a section right now, Kirk and Yeshayah, where Yahweh begins the 14th chapter of Yeshayah with a profound statement, a statement that that, dear Christian, you're lugging this around in your Bible. You ought to read it sometime because it, this one statement completely destroys your religion. God says, you know, in the last days, on my return, I'm going to choose Yisrael because I love them. I am choosing Yisrael. Not choosing Goyim. Not choosing a church. I am choosing Yisrael. I'm going to demonstrate my love and my mercy to Yisrael. And only to Yisrael. Which means your Gentile church did not replace Yisrael. It's black and white. I prefer, I will choose Yisrael because I love Yisrael. He is the one and only God. He doesn't care at all for your church. In fact, he despises it. The very people you hate, he loves. Isn't that remarkable?
Yeah.
You know what follows is something I found very uncomfortable to translate.
Mm-hmm.
And it's at the end of it, it says that this is a parable, so it may be a be used as a as an example to teach a lesson. But it's pretty vivid,
mm-hmm.
And so I'm I'm inclined to think it's a true story, and there is some poetic justice to the whole thing. Do you know what's going to happen to every world leader?
Incarcerated.
Well, they'll eventually end up. Every world leader is going to Sheol. In fact, he even says that all world leaders. He said that Sheol is very excited to welcome you. Sheol is hell, and it's very clear. It's every world leader. All means all. That's what all means, and
mm-hmm.
It's cold in Hebrew. All.
Mm-hmm.
Every world leader is going to Sheol. But what is that part didn't bother me at all. But you know, during the millennial Shabbat, there was going to be slaves.
Really?
All the people that oppressed God's chosen people, that oppressed and abused those he loved, are going to serve as slaves. They're going to do the menial jobs during the millennial Shabbat. Turnabout's fair play, man. They oppressed and enslaved Jews. Well, they're going to be turned into domestic servants. There is something, though, somehow poetic about seeing the Pope in a sanitation engineer's uniform down on his knees scrubbing a public latrine. There's something poetic about having an Islamic jihadist willing to strap a suicide bomb to his back and wield a knife mutilating Jewish women and children in service of his wannabe God, having to sweep their floors and carry out their trash. And that's the way it's going to be. Now, that may sound uncomfortable to modern sensibilities. But it defines love.
Mm-hmm.
If you try to create a family or a community and you forget the two essential rules, the equation that makes a loving, productive, and healthy family or community possible, if you forget either one of the two, you have no chance of prevailing. God hasn't forgotten either one of the two. You know what the two are? They're really simple. You have to encourage and reward behavior that is productive and nurturing.
And have a consequence for them.
And beneficial. So you've got to reward and encourage behavior that is beneficial and nurturing. When somebody in your family does something well, granddaughter all the time, when you know, she was, we took her to lunch today, and and she did some things at lunch today that were really grown up, very, just good behavior. We applauded her for it. We told her how wonderful it was. We, gave her another crayon out of the box and another sticker out of the book, and rewarded the behavior. We encouraged it. We acknowledged it. We rewarded it. But there's another half of that equation. If you genuinely love, you have to discourage, you have to scorn, and you have to punish bad behavior, that which is counterproductive and abusive. And so the whole idea of compelling those that abused Yisrael to serve as slaves for Yisrael for 1,000 years fits into the proper definition of what it is to create a loving and productive family.
Mm-hmm.
And it dawned on me as I was writing this too, because I think I'm we're a lot alike in this regard, probably Scott too, is that we all like work.
Yeah,
I like work. I enjoy it. I work every day on these translations and analysis. I like work. Even when I was working, I liked work. Work is something that gives you a sense of value, character, productivity, sense of worth. And so I like it. I don't want servants. I don't want servants. I'd rather do it myself.
You know, if you have a caddy.
I don't even have a problem carrying my own clothes. My knee is not what it used to be, so I'm having a little trouble with playing golf these days. I've only really had a caddy in two places, and both of those places are just extraordinary. Old Head in Ireland and Pebble Beach, mm-hmm. Golf course are the only two places. And it's either golf cart or a caddy in those places. And I just thought, why not do that the caddy experience once? And it was marvelous. I liked it. I like work. So I'd rather not have these scumbags around.
Mm-hmm.
But unless God makes an example and says, I just want you to know, I want those that I love to know that when they were abused, I cared. And that when you cried out to me and said, somebody's got to hold these disgusting people accountable, I heard you. And it's right. And also keep in mind that for the those that will be slaves in Yisrael for the 1,000 years, it's a tremendous reprieve. It's a pardon, if you will. Not really a pardon in the sense of they're going to end up in Sheol, but they've got 1,000 years before they go.
Oh, the ultimate, yeah.
Yeah. So they're going to be treated vastly better during that 1,000 years than what they're going to endure thereafter. And it's kind of fair play for them to have seen what they're going to forego.
Mm-hmm. Didn't you find it interesting during the Exodus when they're coming out of Mitzrayim and Yahweh makes them pay all the back wages?
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was cool.
Yeah.
This guy has a great sense of humor.
Yeah.
A balance.
Yeah, they're going to give you all those jewels and precious stones mm-hmm. and all that sort of thing. It's their way of squaring the equation of saying, we made you work as slaves. That's not appropriate. You deserve to go away with the
parting gifts.
Parting gifts. And so we're going to give them to you, even though it's been a rough go here and it's going to get rougher. Might as well give it to them because the Amalekites would have stolen it anyway, wouldn't they?
That's true.
So those are my two rants. You just have to be a mental midget. An absolute religious moron.
Well,
to celebrate
Christmas. Put one little thing in?
Yeah.
Terry found some articles, and I was just glancing over them a little while ago. On December the 12th, the U.S. and Israelis signed an agreement kind of under the microscope. I mean, kind of under the...
behind the curtains, under the rug.
Yeah. Along also included Saudi Arabia and some of it preparing for the war with Iran, where they had a lot to do with them declaring Jerusalem, according to these two writers, Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. And it's like a scenario where they really, really, really want to fight with Iran. And but it's Russian backed, and they think, I guess they think, according to these writers, they think they can move on to China and on to North Korea. I mean, these people have all these scenarios ready to go. It's like right before us. I mean, they're doing it because they because of Iran's nuclear path, and also the connection it has that Iran has with Hezbollah and Syria. So everything, yeah, we're right. I mean, you see in the news, and these stupid Americans and political Israel, and why they're in bed with Saudi Arabia. They always seem to be in bed with Saudi Arabia. It just blows me away. I mean, my God, you people are insane.
Yeah. I have not read that. I hope it's not true. That the United States is somehow involving Israel and partnering with Saudi Arabia.
Mm-hmm.
And a war against Iran.
Yeah.
It's as stupid as a war against North Korea.
Yeah.
It's as stupid as a war against Russia.
Russia or China. I mean, are you crazy?
I had a conversation with my son last night, and we were in agreement that there literally is no way to win a war.
Mm-hmm.
The only two ways that you could technically win a war today is to do what was done in Fallujah and Homs and Mosul and Aleppo.
You mean wipe out everything?
You wipe out everything.
Yeah. That ends it.
Those, you know, Mosul had 1 million people in it. It's uninhabitable. It's a graveyard. So you just wipe them out. And there's a lot of people that are just stupid. They say, well, you know, we could just nuke them, you know, wipe them out. Well, what happens is that you get something far worse. You get the migration of millions of people who bring the disease that caused the war in the first place to metastasize like a cancer all around the world. Oh, yeah, that's what happened. And so that's a far worse scenario. The other is that you can use terror, like the northern states did against the South in the Civil War. You make war unsustainable like the United States did on Japan and on Germany.
Or the Indians.
Yeah, the Native American peoples. Is it you firebomb them or you terrorize them such that continuing to fight is impossible because of the civilian cost of the terror that's being perpetrated upon them? But the problem with using a terror is that you become a terrorist.
Mm-hmm.
You lose the moral high ground. And by using terror, like when the United States dropped napalm and Agent Orange on Vietnam, when you use terror tactics, you manufacture more enemy than you kill. And you just simply create your next war. So there is no way to prevail in a war. None. And we lost in Iraq. We lost in Afghanistan. We lost in Libya. We're losing in Syria, and we'll lose that war.
Mm-hmm.
At the cost of trillions of dollars bankrupting the country, and that's small potatoes compared to the cost of losing in Iran. And the United States can't win in Iran. Part of the problem is that this idea that you can wage war through shock and awe and you can bomb people into submission is not true. You can break the government. You can break the infrastructure of the country. But then you have to pay to rebuild it. And then the people that come into power are almost always worse than the ones that were there previously. And it doesn't matter if you outnumber the foe 100-1, or if you're willing to invest millions of your own sons and daughters' lives. It's impossible to occupy the country that you conquer. So all you're doing is you're destroying it, making people really hate you, and then giving it over to a worse government than existed previously.
Mm-hmm.
No, there's no way the United States can occupy and build a nation in Iran or in North Korea or in China or in Russia. And the cost of invading and the cost of attempting to occupy and failing to do so will be in the tens of trillions of dollars. It will, if the United States tries any of these things, it will not survive the encounter.
Well, it seems obvious to most anyone if they just thought about it for a minute.
Yeah.
I mean, what are you doing? You can't get there from here.
Yeah.
Get here from there.
You know, the United States would say that it won the war in the Pacific against the Japanese. Great. The Japanese killed 3,000 Americans because we were really stupid at Pearl Harbor.
Mm-hmm.
We paid no attention to the fact that a Japanese submarine, hours before the attack, tried to enter Pearl Harbor and was found and sunk. We paid no attention to that. Didn't even communicate it. We didn't pay any attention to the fact that there was an entire airborne squadron of Japanese bombers that had been detected by our radio. We didn't even pay any attention. No, the officers were out playing golf. The sailors were sleeping in. It was a Sunday morning. Paid no attention. And so we got 3,000 sailors killed. And we solved that problem by sacrificing 400,000 American lives, avenging the deaths of 3,000. If that's winning,
mm-hmm.
What in the hell is losing?
Well, you not counting all the injured and the lamed and the ones who lose legs and are non-productive or lost breadwinner to the family, all that kind of stuff. I mean, it's a lot more than 300,000. It's millions. Everyone.
Or sacrificing the U.S. Constitution with FDR becoming essentially a fascist president.
Well, people forget that we used up 95% of our oil reserves during this war because we gave it to everybody else that's worth us our own.
Yeah. So, well, not to mention we built the Soviet Union.
That's when we really signed on to half the Soviet.
Yeah, we built the Soviet Union, left Europe worse than we found it.
Mm-hmm.
And then we turned China by betraying Chiang Kai-shek. We turned China over to Mao Zedong, and between our allies in Russia and China, they killed 100 million people,
yeah.
Twice as many as died during the war. If that's winning, what in the hell is losing?
Mm.
And I don't know what losing is if that's winning. And yet, stupidly, we celebrate it. I'd like to return to an amplified version of Barbara Sheath in the beginning, Genesis 6:17. We were studying the story of Noah and how it applied to us today. And this really drives to the heart of the story, and then we'll move on from here. Barbara Sheath in the beginning, Genesis 6:17, reads as follows. It begins with henna, a really important word, henna. It's just translated behold, and people just kind of overlook it. But henna is it's got two hays in it. The hay is a person standing up, looking up to God. The middle letter is depicts a sperm. So it is a child being born to two people looking up and reaching up to God. A henna is the depiction of a human family that's paying attention to God.
Male and female.
Male and female. Yeah, the last hay is a woman, a mother, and the first hay is a man, the father. Now, look up and pay very close attention to me. Wa, Annie, Hina. Therefore, behold, here I am. Stand up. Look up. Reach up to me. In addition, listen carefully to me and to this narrative, considering every detail being especially cognizant of the context, here and now, at the present time, recognizing that this point is emphasized to provide an important contrast. I myself am going to return and bring accordingly the flood. The flood of waters upon this region to devastate and destroy the corruption of every human prone to preaching, in whom is a living spirit from beneath the spiritual realm. All who are in the region will pass away. Beyond henna, there's some very interesting terms here. The first, the verb, I myself am going to return and bring, is bo. This is not the only time that God has returned. No, he was here in the garden with Adam.
Mm-hmm.
So he's going to return to restore the earth. He's going to do so with water because water is the universal solvent.
Mm-hmm. Cleansing. Yeah.
Cleansing. It's upon the Eretz. Eretz can be translated earth, but it doesn't mean the planet. It means region, land, or material realm. The purpose of it was to devastate and destroy the corruption. Shakat. To neget. Every time I see this, I just like it. It's...
Sounds good, yeah.
You know, it's... the longer I have engaged... Yeah, it's slime pit. The longer I have engaged translating Yahweh's word and thinking about who he is and what he's offering and what he's asking of us and what he likes and what he doesn't like, my proclivities, my preferences have come to mirror his. So I'll find myself writing something as a parable or as an example to illustrate a point and say, you know, you ought to look at it this way, like, you know, the Christian New Testament is a slime pit. The words in it are like reptilian discharge that are being analyzed in a swamp. and then I'll, you know, translate something God says, and he refers to human corruption as a putrid slime pit. It's just a perfect metaphor to describe these things. Human incarceration in a lifeless dungeon and the decay leading to death and destruction in Sheol. Every human prone to preaching. You and I talked about this last week. This word is Bashar.
Sure.
And your English Bible is going to translate that all flesh. Does God have anything against flesh?
No, sir.
No. In fact, the criticism of that which is flesh, of that which is material, comes from the most popular religion circa maybe 200 BCE to around 200 CE. For 400 years, there was the equivalent of socialist secular humanism's political correctness. And it was called Gnosticism. And it was embraced by the enlightened, the progressives. And what they basically said is that, you know, that conservative values and in human achievement and that which is of the flesh is inferior to the great enlightenment of the spirit. Pauline Christianity is based on Gnosticism, this antagonism towards the flesh and this love of that which is faith and spirit and nebulous. What did Yahweh say when he created a plant and animal life?
He said it was good. He liked it.
It was good. He liked it.
Great stuff.
Right. Does he have anything against animals?
Not a bit. He likes them.
He likes them. Yeah, not a bit. So, to translate Bashar, all flesh, it's just stupid.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not even the primary definition of the word. It's the secondary definition of the word. Why would you go to the secondary definition of the word when it makes no sense, when the primary definition of the word is perfectly consistent with the concept of corruption?
Maybe to twist.
Yeah, animals aren't corrupt, by the way. Yeah, animals aren't corrupt. No such thing as a corrupt animal.
Mm.
They do what they do.
Yeah.
Part of nature.
They kill to eat.
Well, and some don't even do that, you know?
Yeah.
Well, I guess if you're a cow or a lamb, you're killing the grass.
Yeah.
But, it's the circle of life.
Even the
tree must lose its leaves, and they must fall to create the kind of nutrients in the soil that the roots then can pull up and spring forth a new life each year. That's a circle of life.
Mm-hmm.
We all are born and we die, and our bodies decompose. So the primary definition of Bashar is to preach, to convey tidings, which are perceived to be good. Doesn't mean they are good, but it's like the Christian New Testament, which they call gospel, which is the good news. He's talking about people who are preaching.
Mm-hmm. And that was missed by everybody.
Correct. Now, this is the next thing that's really interesting here. And I guess it's supposedly possible that a demonic spirit can occupy an animal other than a human, and humans are animals. I mean, there's the couple of examples in the Christian New Testament of exorcising demons from pigs. And
only for a few moments. They couldn't.
Yeah, only for a few moments.
And, not a permanent deal.
Right, not a permanent deal. And I don't even know why those stories are there. I'm not fond of anything in the Christian New Testament. I really don't get much beyond the core of what is recorded in Matthew anyway.
Yeah.
But because he was at least an eyewitness. But this says Ruach Chaim. Now, Chaim is the plural of Che, which is life. But Ruach is spirit.
Mm-hmm.
The spiritual beings are like the Moloch.
Mm-hmm.
We're not a spiritual being. We can become spiritual in one of two ways. We can be born anew from above by our spiritual mother, the set-apart spirit, and become part of Yahweh's covenant family. And then that spirit is not ours, it is Yahweh's. But it unites us with him, perfects us, nurtures us, enlightens us, teaches us. At this very moment, there were only 8 such individuals on the planet. And none of them were being destroyed because none of them were corrupt.
Mm-hmm.
But there is another spirit. And that is the spirits associated with the fallen Moloch. They're made exactly like the productive Moloch who serve Yahweh, except there was a flaw in their programming, and they united with Hasatan, the adversary, and they can and do possess people. And in this particular region of Mesopotamia, and most of this region would have been from maybe as far south as Ur. The earliest civilizations of humankind, we don't talk much about them because we just don't know much about them.
They didn't write.
But the earliest civilization, the place that God is specifically talking about, is around the shores of the Black Sea back at the time that the Black Sea was freshwater.
Yeah, Turkish.
Yeah. Along the shore, yeah, it'd be far, far eastern Turkey, but that whole area around the Black Sea. That was before the Bosphorus Straits were even opened, and that was before the the water level of the Black Sea turned to rose 500 feet and turned to salt. That is where the civilizations are that are specifically being talked about here. And that is where Adam and Chawa left the garden. That's why when God says, you know, I'm going to put a sign on them that tells the people out there, leave them alone. Don't harm them. This is where the people were living at that time. And then as they began, Adam, Chawa, and Cain, to marry with the and have, you know, relations with the humans outside of the garden, they created humans with a nesama. They passed on their conscience.
Mm-hmm.
And many of these individuals, based on this testimony, became demon-possessed. So the people he's trying to wipe out are demon-possessed. That's what this says.
Mm-hmm.
Whom there is a living spirit, Ruach Chayim. So Hasatan was, and his boys were having a heck of a time right there early on trying to turn creation against God. Yeah, to ruin the whole thing. And that's really you know, gets to the heart of who Satan is and what he wants. What he wants is that when Yahweh started spending all of this time with his new creation, with Adam, whom he gave an Asama, a conscience, the ability to be judgmental, to exercise good judgment, to be discerning, to think. And free will, which is something that the Moloch do not have, engaged in a relationship with Adam and spent lots of time and was thrilled with that relationship. And old Hasatan, who was one of the big three Moloch at the time,
mm-hmm.
resented it. And so he says, I'll be like God. I can do a better job than this. I'm more important than they are. And the way that he wanted to get back at God was to destroy it, was to corrupt his creation, to get the creation to worship this misprogrammed implement. So Satan became the god of religion. He is Jesus Christ. He is the Lord. He is Allah. He is Shiva.
Mm-hmm.
He is Buddha. He is, you know, Confucius. He is the object of human devotion. And that's how he has positioned himself. So that's what God is trying to eliminate, and it's in the region, and it says that all will pass away. Now, the spirits can't pass away,
no.
But the people they had possessed will pass away. The 6:18 reads, "Then I will take a stand, establishing my covenant with you, and you will come to and enter and be included within the ark, you and your sons, your wife, and your sons' wives with you." What had to happen before God could establish his covenant with Noah? Evil people. Religion.
Mm-hmm.
Politics. Had to be removed. You can't engage in a covenant relationship with God until such time as you disassociate with those things. God had to first wipe those things out, and then he could establish his covenant with Noah. The covenant with Noah could not precede the elimination of those things. Now, the reason that's important is that
you can't have a covenant until you do those. That's the first step.
Correct. That's the lone prerequisite to disengage from human affairs. And the reason this is so important, you know, so many people want to know about, they would call it Bible prophecy. You know, there's no such thing as Bible unless you're talking about Biblos, a Biblia. not Biblia, but Babel, which is corruption and from intermixing, and means with the Lord. The Lord is Satan. Well, I'm going to tell you that the single most important thing that God could possibly tell you about the future. You want to know about the future? The earth will be transformed into the conditions experienced in the Garden of Eden. And God must do that to restore the earth and to restore his covenant relationship with his children. Until all forms of government, all forms of politics, all forms of religion, all forms of militarism, all human corruption and pollution is removed from the earth, God can't camp out in a covenant relationship, a family relationship with his children.
Yeah.
This is being told from that perspective. So if you want to know the most important insight that you could have in terms of prophecy,
mm-hmm.
it's that we are returning to Eden. That's why the doorway to Pesach Passover leads to Sukkah, camping out with God.
Right.
That's why every statement that God makes about his return, he says first he's going to wipe out every world leader, wipe out all militaries, wipe out all vestiges of government and politics and religion,
mm-hmm.
and then he's going to restore the earth, and we're going to live with him on an earth that's in the conditions found at the Garden of Eden, with the trees themselves singing for 1,000 years.
He's very plain. I mean, I'm not trying to be trite. No. I mean, first statement, you can't have other gods with me and be in my presence. I mean, this goes on and
yes.
on and on.
He's very clear about it.
Walk away.
But that's the single most important insight that I could give anyone in terms of what's going to happen.
Yeah.
God's going to rid the world of all traces of religion and politics, man's corruption and pollution. And if you're religious and political, that means you. And then he's going to restore the entire earth such that it exemplifies the conditions found in the Garden of Eden. And then he's going to live here with his family for 1,000 years. That's the single most important bit of prophecy. And that's what's being told in this story. And the way it's being told here is to reinforce that. Then I will make a stand, establishing my covenant. He didn't say the first of three covenants. He didn't say the first of six covenants. He didn't say the old covenant.
No.
He didn't even say the oldest covenant. He has one family, one covenant. Bereth, which is the Hebrew word for familial covenant relationship, is always singular. Even when God says, I'm going to renew it and restore it. And by the way, that's what renew and restore means. We're going to go back to the conditions found at Eden. I'm going to renew the earth. I'm going to restore it to those conditions. And I'm going to renew and restore the original covenant such that it is observed and celebrated the way it was intended. Always singular. There is no renewed covenant. There is no New Testament. Then I will take a stand and establish my covenant with you. And you will come and enter and be included in the ark. What was necessary for Noah and his wife and sons and their wives to enter the ark? There was a prerequisite for them entering the ark, wasn't there?
Well, let's see. They had to agree to the terms and conditions of the covenant.
They absolutely did, and they had to listen to what God had to say and then do what he asked. And that's how you participate in the covenant now. You have to listen to what God has to say about it. He provides instructions, and then you have to accept them and act upon them. Mm-hmm. If you don't know what they are, you can't accept them. If you don't act upon them, it doesn't make any difference whatsoever, even if you know what they are.
Yeah, that's true. Absolutely.
The first statement we found about Noah What was he doing? He was walking apart.
Walking away.
Right. Right. Exactly the same thing we learn about Abraham. Man, he was 500 miles away from her, or maybe more than that. A long way away from her in Babylon. Moshe was a long way away from Egypt.
Yeah.
You know, Dode wasn't found in the midst of the Israeli army.
No.
He wasn't sitting there at Saul's side, you know, engaged in Israeli politics. He was out pasturing some sheep. Some isolated pasture up there. Didn't even know where he was.
No, they didn't even know they'd be looking for him. They said, well, we still have one other boy.
Yeah, I know you're not even interested, but there is another one.
You know, this little kid out there, this Dode.
That's not involved in any of this.
Yeah.
Set apart from it all. And we're told that Noah walked alone with God, which means that he wasn't engaged in the politics or the religion or the killing or the depravity or the corruption of man. And so that is the first requirement. God's not going to even introduce himself to you. You will have no chance of getting to know him unless you first walk away from these things. You know, I'm having, and we'll talk about more, a little more about this, not a lot, but a little more about this tonight.
Mm-hmm.
That group called Discord that is saying some very unkind things about me and my translations and books, even though none of them would know any of the things they profess if it hadn't been for these shows and my books. But they seem to have forgotten about that. They're of the belief that we really should be loving and happy and accepting and just get along with everybody. Exactly the opposite. If we're getting along, if we're accepting, if we're tolerant, if we're loving of everybody, then we're mired in the world. And there's no way in the world that we can engage in a relationship with God. You not only need to distance yourselves from those things, your view of government and militaries and politics and religion needs to mirror God's. Your choice to walk away from them cannot be because, well, I was told to do so. It needs to be because I wanted to do so. Because I realize those things are dishonest, counterproductive, that ultimately they will fail me. And as a person who has done so, it's incumbent upon you to tell others that your religion is stupid. Like we began this program. If you believe the Quran was inspired by God, you're an idiot. Just an idiot. You think Jerusalem is part of a capital of a Palestinian state? You're a fool. You celebrated Christmas? You're a moron. It's important to tell it bluntly and boldly as it is. And so Noah knew that those things were not trustworthy, and he left them. That's why God spoke to him.
Mm-hmm.
And he's not going to introduce himself to anyone who doesn't make that move first. Now, that doesn't mean you have to know everything about God and the terms and conditions of the covenant for him to introduce himself. No, but you're not part of his family just with an introduction. Just because you can pronounce his name, which is a good start.
Mm-hmm.
Just because you know that the covenant is important, which is it's
excellent.
Also positive. Just because you know that the Torah means teaching, these are all steps in the right direction. Just because you celebrate and attend the Moed Mikre, another good call. But you really got to think these things through. Got to understand them. You need to do what, you know, I've said that when we were, I was laughing about slime pit. I said, no, the longer I do this, the more my my inclination is to see things the same way Yahweh does.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's kind of what you need to do.
Yeah.
It ought to be that way. You know, I like him. We're buds. I spend a lot of time together. I admire him.
You should hate to have a revulsion for Christmas.
You should.
I mean, really, I noticed the difference this year is our neighborhood is a lot like some of these. They just light this place up. It's mm-hmm. We're conspicuous by our lack of anything. I'm surprised they haven't knocked on our door.
You know, I would tell you that
it's revolting to me now. I mean, it's not just that intolerant. I mean,
if somebody wants to put white lights on a fence, you know, or something. Lights are pretty. I happen to like lights. I'm a big fan of lights. More lights the happier. I like lights.
But
if you're going to put up a manger.
But I look at the symbols.
Yeah, you're going to put up a manger.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh my God, you are just really, really lost. Really lost.
Yeah.
It's just pathetic what you've done with your life. So anyway, to be included within the ark, they had to step away from civilization. Let those morons that were out there celebrating their religious holidays, out killing for the fun of killing, or into governing and this sort of thing, had to walk away from those things. Then they had to listen to what God said, because that ark didn't magically appear. They built it based upon Yahweh's instructions. That's the only reason they could walk upon it.
Mm-hmm.
And you notice that it is almost always this way with God. How many people did he speak to originally?
One, two later, but one first.
One first, and then, if you look, I'm telling the story of the ark, it was Noah. But Noah didn't board the ark alone, did he?
No, he had it was eight of them.
Right, family. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yahweh spoke to Moshe.
Yes.
You know, we're hundreds of thousands of Israelis in Goshen as slaves. How many people did he speak to initially?
He just spoke to Moshe.
One. And then Moshe was joined by his brother, Aaron.
Aaron, uh-huh.
And then they were joined by many more.
Mm-hmm.
It is the way that God works. He's going to pick a person at a time. That person has the opportunity to say yes or no. We can go almost 2,500 years where God couldn't find a single person that had walked away from religion and politics, who was willing to listen to him and accept his invitation to engage in a relationship. 2,500 years, nobody. And maybe not completely true. Obviously, the disciples were. So
small group. They didn't last long.
small group. And they found others that were willing to listen immediately thereafter. But they, as a group, they were swallowed up between Akiba's rabbinical hatred of them, and his false messiah, Bar Kokhba, and by the Gnostics that were known as Christians today, that were poisoned by Paul, and their voice was drowned out. So, with the exception of maybe 100 years, couldn't find anybody.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty astounding. But Noah listened, and as a result, he was not alone. You know, God's whole concept is to build a family. And so, he's happy to work. He was happy just to be with Adam all by himself. But, he gave Adam Chawa so that Adam and Chawa could experience what it means, in a very tangible way, to be part of a family. And that's why when, 15 years ago or so, more, Yahweh introduced himself and And for a good long time, I was working alone. But it didn't continue to be alone. I mean, now there's hundreds of us. We communicate in all sorts of ways and have a marvelous relationship. It's not intended to be alone, but even when it was just one, I was never alone. And I know that there's a lot of people that become, you know, the first time they hear this and they want to become part of the Covenant family, and they reach out and say, you know, is there somebody where I can have fellowship? You know, I don't, you know, I'm all alone. There's nobody in my family or my hometown. And, you know, we created the Yada Yada Forum for that purpose, so people could talk about the issues and try to understand the Torah, prophets, and Psalms better. And just a community forum for the family. I don't want to sound cold here, and I know this is one of the big criticisms that people have of me, because I don't engage in any of the social forums. There have been a lot of social forums that are around this site, most of which have gone wacko crazy, and we've had to disassociate ourselves with them. But I've never participated in any of them. How many times have we talked on the phone, Kirk, apart from this program?
I don't think we do. I wouldn't never know your number if I had to find it.
Yeah, never, never. You know that that I exchange emails with Jackie, sure, who does the edits of this program, the edits of the text of the things I've written. You know how many times I've talked to her on the telephone?
Probably the same time, number of mine.
Right.
Me.
Yeah, how often have I visited you in person?
You haven't, because you had to play golf with me.
Yeah, that's right. We go out and play. I'm going to spend an eternity with you. I don't have a need. I really don't even have a desire for that. My covenant relationship is primarily one-on-one with Yahweh. Do I like sharing what we do and learn together?
You must.
Absolutely. I do.
Okay.
But I don't have this need for fellowship, and I just am really uncomfortable in social media settings.
I don't know how to find you. I mean, I'm not a computer person at all. So, I mean, it's only 5 years ago I got on the computer and learned how to open this thing up so I could read it. I mean, so it ain't my. I think you have to be brought up with that stuff. If
you're an analog guy in a digital world.
Yeah, pretty much.
You know, I've actually started and run two computer-oriented, internet-based companies. So, you know, I'm a little more comfortable in the digital world, but I don't like that kind of thing. I you know, I'm happy to exchange emails with people and happy to do this show, but, you know, I guess I find, we talked about this, the idea of perfect and complete before the show. I'm really comfortable in my relationship with you. You know, something happened to me a little less than a week ago. But I don't think it's ever happened to me before. It was, my family was, you know, gathered inside, you know, and it was snowing outside. It was a beautiful evening. It was snowing outside. And I just walked outside. And I looked at the snow coming down. And God says, I'm really pleased. I'm proud of what we're doing together. I'm pleased with all of it. Never heard that before. Didn't ask for it. Well, I had a sense that, you know, he was happy with what we were doing. We've accomplished a lot. We've had a lot of fun together. We've learned a lot.
Oh, yeah.
He hasn't learned much, but I've learned a lot. And but, you know, that's the whole purpose of this kind of relationship. It's been a joy, and it's been productive, and it's been fun, and you know, I've enjoyed his participation, contribution, partnership.
Mm-hmm.
But just walked outside and this beautiful snow, and his voice just resonated in me. I'm really pleased with everything we're doing. What more do you need than that? What more could you want than that?
That'll do it.